If you are a compliance officer, especially in big international company, and you still have a subsidiary in Russia, you need to think about it because it's a big ethical issue. If you continue to work after 2.5 years, if you continue to work and operate in Russia, I cannot imagine any excuse to be present in this kind of state for after 2.5 years of full-fledged work. It's also an ethical dilemma when you have to choose between two bad options, but you need to do the right thing, basically.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and develop organizations with a remarkably healthy culture that can positively impact all of its stakeholders. Every other Thursday, we drop hour-long conversations with world-leading researchers and experts on culture, ethics, change, and leadership. My name is Tobias Sturesson, and I'm your host and the co-founder of Art Management. How do you navigate ethics under the extreme pressures of war? Since Russia's full-fledged invasion of Ukraine in 2022, there has been ruthless targeting of Ukraine's energy infrastructure, particularly during harsh winter conditions. Despite heavy bombardment, Ukraine has managed to defend its energy grid integrity, largely due to the dedication of Ukraine's national energy company, Ukrenergo's thousands of team members who work tirelessly under life-threatening conditions of snow, wind, frost, rain, constant shelling, and even mines. Gleb Bakalov assumed the role of Chief Compliance Officer at Ukrenergo in 2018 as part of efforts to strengthen integrity, embed ethics, and combat corruption in Ukrainian state-owned enterprises. Little did Gleb know that 3.5 years later, he would be leading this function amidst a full-fledged invasion. In my interview with Gleb, we explore the challenges of combating corruption in a country ranked 104 on Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index, which is yet making big strides toward improvement. Gleb shared insights into Ukrenergo's ethics initiatives and how the war has reshaped everything. We delved into navigating values dilemmas when faced with only terrible choices. And we concluded with Gleb's advice for executives and ethics leaders in the context of Russia's attack. I'm grateful to Gleb for his openness and remarkable resilience amid extreme circumstances. And I believe his experiences offer valuable lessons for all of us. Gleb is also the executive chair of the Ukrainian Network of Integrity and Compliance. As I record this introduction, I'm heartened by the recent substantial support package for Ukraine passed by the U.S. Congress after months of delay. Having a Ukrainian wife and having had team members in Ukraine for over 10 years, I have some understanding of the beauty of this country, but also of its challenges. War inflicts unspeakable suffering, and the pain and trauma will linger long after the fighting ceases. However, as Gleb and I discussed, we remain hopeful for a brighter future for Ukraine, one of peace, strengthened institutions, a fairer society, and a more robust economy. Before we jump into the conversation, this podcast today is brought to you by the Culture and Leadership Program. Today, delivering excellent products and services is crucial but insufficient. To sustain trust with key stakeholders, organizations must prioritize integrity, align decisions with their values, and cultivate a workplace culture that both delivers results and supports employee thriving. This is a daunting task. despite lofty aspirations, ambitious HR initiatives, and compliance programs, managers and executives are often ill-equipped to nurture cultural health, drive behavioral change, or make values-based decisions when under pressure. Heart Management has designed an organization-specific transformative program to help you address these issues in a sustainable way. Visit cultureandleadership.org for more information and free downloads. But now, without further ado, let's jump into my conversation with Gleb Bakalov. Gleb, it's such a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
And I understand that you've been a listener to the podcast for a while.
I'm a big fan of your podcast. It's very useful, particularly for compliance officers. I think most of your podcasts, they're all relevant. And I think that all recent compliance trends show that there will be a huge focus on corporate culture in general and on ethical culture, on people's behavior while dealing with rules and regulations in particular. So yeah, it's quite useful podcast for compliance.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that, Gleb. And I'm so glad that we can have this conversation and we're going to reflect on many different things together. And I was so happy when we connected and you were willing to come on. And of course, the full-on brutal invasion in Ukraine has been going on for over 2 years now. And as a Ukrainian living in Kyiv, Ukraine, just first a personal question, how are you doing?
It's challenging. It's not a crime that to live even in Kyiv, where there's a good air defense. It's also quite challenging. We have a lot of air raids, missiles, attacks, etc. And we constantly involved in helping our soldiers on the front line.
How do you get used to living in that situation, or do you get used to it?
I try to get used to this kind of situation because it's long for 2.5 years. And basically for me, it's like one long day started back in 2022. It doesn't end actually. So it's for a lot of Ukrainians, it's like one long day, all this war.
I think it's very difficult for many of us to even begin to imagine the kind of pressured work environment that your company, Ukrenergo, is experiencing. And as Russia has done a lot of brutal attacks on Ukraine's energy system, can you give us a short introduction to what your company does and also how your work has been impacted by the war?
Yeah, Ukrenergo is quite an important company for Ukraine. We are a transmission system operator. So we transmit electricity across the whole country. My colleagues are responsible for holding this balance in the whole of Ukraine. And we basically transport electricity from the generation, from the power plants, to the local distribution operators. So we are responsible for this important part of critical infrastructure. And since the start of this war, we were one of the main targets for Russian attacks. Unfortunately, 6 of my colleagues, they were killed on the spot while they were working, because Russians desperately want to deprive of electricity in the middle of the last winter, just to make a humanitarian catastrophe for millions of Ukrainians. And I'm very glad and we were lucky that they didn't succeed. Our company will play a crucial part in stabilizing the whole electricity system of Ukraine in general, and we managed to hold last winter, and thankfully this winter was quite good. But for the last 2 weeks, they started again targeting our substations, our power lines. We see this aggression holding, and we see it's continuing. And unfortunately, even civil companies like mine became a target for this drones, missiles, attacks. I mean, Russia, they said they want to throw us back in the Stone Age. That was their idea. They publicly speak about it on their television, national television. were like lucky that they didn't succeed.
Wow. Wow. I'm reflecting on that when you are under such like constant stress and also, of course, the trauma. And I mean, my wife is Ukrainian. We have family out on the front lines and, of course, a lot of friends. And yet we are far removed. I mean, from the fighting, we don't experience any of that, only the stress of our family and friends. And I'm just reflecting on what do you do on a more personal level to just cope with that? Because I think when you were in a traumatic experience, when it lasts for a day or an hour or a week, it's one thing. But then over 2 years, where that's constant threat, because as you expressed, it's not just the stress of the functions of your company going down, but it's actually the threat to human life, even to your own.
I think a lot of Ukrainians, maybe millions, will be already traumatized because of that. And we will need some maybe general psychological help when the war will be ended. I hope it will be soon. We will need some time to heal ourselves. I agree, even for civilians who are not on the front line, it's also a very challenging experience. You live in a constant fear of missiles attacks. As you know, there is no safe place in Ukraine. Russian missiles can hit every building, especially civilian ones, so you are not safe anywhere, actually. So you, every time you need to go, when there is an air siren, you have to go to the shelter, and it's really useful because sometimes it may save your life, literally.
Thank you for sharing that, Gleb. And so to think a bit more about the topic of like ethics and corruption, Ukraine is ranked 104 on Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index. However, they also write, and I wrote recently, that Ukraine is one of the few significant improvers, noting that the country has taken important steps to improve oversight and accountability and actually moved up in the index. So they're really seeing very positive signals from Ukraine. And I also think it's really important for people from the outside just to reflect on that Ukraine only gained independence from Soviet in 1991. So it's basically a history of market economy of about 30 years, in my understanding. And I think if you compare that, let's say, with Sweden or the US, of course, that's, we had so much longer histories of market economy and capitalism and so on. But what do you see as some of the most critical challenges related to corruption in Ukraine?
I think I could share my personal experience. It will show what a huge progress Ukraine has done in this sphere. I used to work in private sector. I'm a private compliance officer. I work for international insurance companies. 5 years ago, there was a start of this corporate reform, corporate governance reform in the SOEs in Ukraine in general. The biggest SOEs, Ukrainian SOEs, tried to create a compliance function in order to tackle corruption in more effective way. We hold a public competition in order to fill this position. I was the winner back 5 years ago. We also involved anti-corruption watchdog like Transparency International in order to be fully transparent. It was very useful for me because I need to gain trust, especially from my employees, that I'm not linked to any officials or politicians, that I'm an independent person. The main criteria for this competition was not to be involved in any state-owned entities, any state service. So they're trying to look for a person completely out of this sphere in order to be trusted by employees, by different stakeholders. And I guess that's the example of Ukrenergo. And there are some many more companies, I mean, state-owned entities, who already conducted this kind of transition. And they tried to be open, transparent, create this compliance function. And also, Ukrenergo, we implemented and launched a supervisory board with the majority of independent members, mostly foreigners. It's a classic structure, basically, it's a true line of defense structure, independent internal auditor. We have compliance, we have the first line, supervisory board, and the management executive committee. So it's all present in our company. And it's very useful for us because we need to build a lot of, we are involved in construction of the substations, the grid in general, and we need foreign investments. That's why it was so important for us to show that we are transparent, that we are tackling and fighting corruption, and foreign investors can trust us with their money, and then we'll be saved in our company.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that. I think that's really encouraging to see. And I think when we think about corruption, of course, one of the big challenges, I think, has been, of course, the issue of oligarchs, but also people, if you think in the public sector, who have like enriched themselves on finances. And I remember many years ago, and I think, as you know, I've spent a lot of time in Ukraine, and I remember my friends telling me, for example, if a police officer stopped us, like, I mean, check so that they don't put something on you, or like, I mean, just this thing. And for example, my wife was a managing director of a company in Ukraine who fought really hard not to pay bribes, and where there was really this challenge with, for example, the local customs office and so on, and tax offices, where you would often get kind of these extra costs that weren't real, that you shouldn't really pay and so on. And it was really hard to refuse to pay them. And I'm thinking about these issues. And of course, I've also understood how so many things have changed over these years. And again, I think it's very easy to judge from the outside and just say, oh, people are unethical. But it's not really that easy, because it's also really a system where so many people have been very underpaid. And it's been basically, I think, built into the system that you do get some of your income from other efforts in that sense. And I'm just thinking, in a company like yours, you have 7,000 employees. When we think about this culture change, kind of driving this change to really support integrity, ethical behavior, responsible leadership, and of course, it's challenging under any circumstance, and you're trying to drive that in the midst of a war. And yet, of course, it is an integral part of Ukraine's ambition to build back better. In my perspective, of course, you cannot say that there will be a win out of this war in that sense, because, I mean, so many people's lives have been lost and nothing can ever replace that. But of course, a positive outcome, if we could dream, would be that Ukraine would come out, in one sense, stronger for future generations, stronger institutions, stronger companies that are a higher level of integrity, better relationship with other countries and experts and so on. But when you think about kind of driving that culture change within the company, what are some things that you see are really key to doing that? I think especially in an environment where certain things are just like, these are the way things are done around here. It's nothing strange, but it is more regular practice.
I think the main driver is the demand from the people, actually. Because since the revolution of dignity in 2014, the mindset of people has changed significantly. The demand from the people to the government to fight corruption is increasing every year. The government has to respond one way or another. There is no choice for them. That's why there is such a good progress in terms of anti-corruption, because the people in general, they are not trying to deal with it anymore since the revolution of dignity. It was 10 years ago. That's why all these reforms in anti-corruption sphere, we have created a lot of anti-corruption institutions, authorities like National Anti-Corruption Prevention Bureau, Bureau for Investigation of Corruption. We have even specialized anti-corruption court, and they bring some results. Top politicians who were corrupt, they actually started to go to jail for significant terms. And it shows there is a progress in this sphere. And population, the people of Ukraine who see this result, that's what they will try to achieve by this revolution of dignity. They want to see justice. They want to see that people who corrupt at the top level of the government, they actually go to jail for 5, 6, 10 years, because of their corruption. And it started to change, and we see these results for the last 3-4 years since the start of this anti-corruption court. And it also reflects on our progress with accession to EU. You know that we have been granted this candidate status for accession to the European Union. Even we are waiting for the negotiations to begin. So it's basically, it's this process is not reversible, so we will see that it will end with our accession to the European Union, and there is no way back in terms of tolerating corruption. As you frankly, and you were right that 10 years ago, maybe longer, there was a lot of examples of bribery on the level of public officials, tax authorities, etc., even patrol police. It's not the case anymore. Frankly, it's changed back before the Revolution of Dignity even. And this kind of change in society, the government cannot ignore, and they are responding in order to meet the people's demand. That's why it's not the government who's pushing this agenda, this anti-corruption reform. It's basically the people who are pushing their governments to do it. This corporate governance reform, a response from the governments to meet the people's demand.
I think that is so, so interesting to hear that it's really driven by that people are fed up with the status quo on that, and they really demand change. And of course, that's what we saw as well in Maidan and so on. And when it comes to how you work with these issues, like in your organizational level, when you think about like working, strengthening, if we say that culture of ethics within your organization, and of course, doing that in the midst of this very, very difficult times. And when you and I had a conversation before, we talked about how hard it is to get time for anything else than just kind of keeping the system working. What are some things that you have seen are like really important to still kind of pushing this forward in the midst of the time that you're in right now?
Yeah, unfortunately, the full-fledged war makes some changes to our compliance plans that we have regarding raising awareness and training. We have to reduce them significantly in order not to distract our people from their direct duties in restoring our infrastructure. Because it was more important to restore and rebuild our substations than to conduct another anti-corruption training. I don't say that we completely abandoned them, but we have significantly reduced their frequency of this such kind of activities. We are also trying to stay connected with our employees. One of the instruments that we used at Ukrenergo is so-called annual ethical culture survey. It's an online survey that we used to do every year in order to detect how our employees perceived ethical culture, whether they feel pressured by their direct managers to do something wrong, not in line with our regulation. Do they feel free to report such kind of wrongdoings directly to their managers or to me as the chief compliance officers? And do they see some examples of employees who are ethical and who are rewarded for being ethical by raising their salary or going to another more profitable position? Do they see such kind of examples about their direct with their colleagues? And this survey helped us to be connected with our employees because we remind them about it through email and have exchange with a lot of them with this kind of activities. Because this trust and lack of fear is very important for state-owned enterprise in Ukraine, because they used to be well connected to the state. And when you work for the state, you feel a little bit disconnected from your managers, and the level of trust is a little bit lower than the private sector. That's what I noticed, and that's what I tried to change. Not only me, because it's more important when your CEO is transparent and frank with the employees. And I try to support, because my manager is CEO, I directly report to the CEO, and I try to consult him what he has to say in terms of compliance and ethics, in order for employees not to be afraid to use our internal hotline, for instance. And we have actually some examples when it was quite useful when our employees report such kind of wrongdoings on our internal hotline, and they helps us to save a lot of money, basically. Prevent some theft, to restore damaged assets due to theft, etc. And this trust has to be built. I think that compliance officers, especially in SOEs, in such countries as Ukraine, they have to be focused on this, on building this trust with their colleagues. Yeah, that's why we try to make this hotline fully anonymous. We understand that it's more convenient for our employees to be fully anonymous, to report these wrongdoings, because they're still afraid of further repercussions. When I talk with my colleagues from different countries, even in US, I've noticed that anonymous reporting is more useful and convenient for employees and direct communication when they have to demean themselves when they make this report. My advice is to communicate as much as possible by using digital instruments like emails, where when you can send several thousand emails to your colleagues and then have a communication with them regarding their issues and questions. When they receive a direct email from chief compliance officers, that's always very pleasant for them, and they feel more connected directly with me as a manager of compliance.
So I think it's really interesting what you're saying. And I think that perhaps sometimes we also have an over-reliance on training, that we think that training people and gathering them to train them in on corruption or bias or whatever. And perhaps it's not necessarily as effective always as we think it is. And I think especially when we put our hope into that and we think that the training is going to fix it, but we don't actually look at the system. And I think perhaps, as I understand what you're saying, is that what you can do right now is basically to work on both to assess and see, so what is the state of when we look at ethical culture within our company, and then also working on decreasing the fear of retaliation so that people will feel okay to bring up their concerns and bring up the issues that they see and really send that message and keep communicating that. And there's something I think about related to that. And we talk a lot in this podcast about the importance of speaking up. And I mean, creating this culture of listening, and where speaking up is valued and encouraged, and where, of course, we bring up values, tensions, and dilemmas that we have. You are in a very special situation, and through conversations with family and friends in Ukraine, I mean, we've heard examples, and just this is from the outside, of ethical dilemmas they face that are just far removed from most people's realities. I mean, of course, just related to war, there's so many dilemmas, and just reflecting on, I mean, family members who are out on the front line, and in one sense, you want to protect the country, in another sense, you care about the lives of your family members, and you don't want them to be out on the front lines because you want them to survive. And of course, in the current situation, there are of course so many different dilemmas that I'm thinking that your employees at every level must be facing.
I fully agree with you. With the start of the full-fledged war, there were a lot of new important ethical dilemmas. When you have to choose between two bad options, actually. One is bad and the other is bad. And you have to choose one, and it's also bad. In philosophy, there is a classic trolley problem when you have to either kill one person or kill another five different person. You have to choose between these two options. It's something like that in this kind of situation. And what I try to communicate with my employees, with my colleagues, when we also conduct this raising awareness activities, when they have a global ethic day in general in the world, we try to bring attention of our employees to these ethical dilemmas. We try to explain which is the different ways to deal with these dilemmas and to choose the right way how to do it. And there is so-called doctrine of double effect, when you have to choose between two bad options, which one will you choose? We try to explain this kind of ways of dealing with these dilemmas to our employees. It's not easy because you have to be a little bit educated in philosophy in order to understand this kind of consequences that brings. But the main principle, basically, the main principle is not to use people as a tool, simply as a tool. That's the main reason maybe in all this ethical problems. When you start to use people simply as tools to achieve your goals, then you are in trouble and you are doing unethical things.
I think that is such an interesting conclusion. And of course, I think that is the issue in so many organizations across the world. As soon as we start seeing people as basically a means to an end, and we see the end as so important, then we fall into a lot of ethical traps. And when We think about talking about ethics and values. I think that is not necessarily so easy in many different respects. And of course, for many of the people listening to this podcast, you're very accustomed to having those conversations. But I think even, of course, different people who are perhaps, if say, white collar workers, blue collar workers, there's might be a difference. There's also difference in cultural, like for example, in different cultural contexts and so on. And how do you raise these topics, I'm thinking, in a way that people feel like they can engage with, for example, when you talk about these are important principles or values or ethical conducts for us at our company? How do you talk about them in a way that you get people to actually engage with that and just don't feel like it's just some nice words that don't mean very little to their reality?
Basically, we try to bring external experts, the one that are interested to our employees. They are already used to listen to me, to my colleagues, and it's not so interesting as it was before. That's why we try to bring in external experts on these ethical theories, ethical dilemmas. And it helps us to raise interest among our employees to participate in such kind of raising awareness initiatives. And every year we're trying to bring another expert that may be interested to our employees. That's why one of the way for our employees to be involved in this activity, because it's not mandatory, it's completely voluntary. So that's the first advice. And the second one, maybe to change subjects, not to be focused completely on, let's say, conflict of interest or anti-corruption, trying to choose different topics for different years. For instance, one year, we ask our employees to write down what ethics means to them and make a photo with this slogan. And the one who will receive more likes on our intranet would receive some presents from compliance office. It was also very interesting. It was before the full-fledged war, and a lot of our employees basically participated and share their position, their views, what is ethics means to them, and share it with other employees. They discuss it on our intranet, write comments. It was very interesting week for us.
Super, super interesting, Gleb. And so I want to end on really for you to speak to our audience. If you think your colleagues around the world who perhaps wonder how they can help support Ukraine. And of course, I mean, they can donate and all of those things, but perhaps especially when it comes to contributing to the work that Ukraine is doing in building stronger institutions and public and private sector, what is something that would be your advice?
When the full-fledged war started back in 2022, I have a few compliance colleagues from Russia that I was connected with. Because they are compliance professional, I expected them to share their position on this war because they deal with ethics. And I cannot imagine a person who works in compliance to be silent on such kind of issues when your role country invade another one and try to destroy another sovereign state. And it was a big surprise for me that none of them expressed anything. They were completely silent. And it was, for me, it was a shock, basically, because they're not 100% compliance officers. If they can be silent in this kind of times, they have to be open and transparent and spread their position on this issue. If you are a compliance officer, especially in big international company, and you still have a subsidiary in Russia, you need to think about it because it's a big ethical issue. If you continue to work after 2.5 years, if you continue to work and operate in Russia, I cannot imagine any excuse, even for pharmaceutical companies or some companies that produce some necessary items for population, to be present in this kind of state for after 2.5 years of full-fledged war. When you use your money, your resources, in order to, your taxes that you pay in Russia, in order to produce missiles, rockets, etc., to kill civilians in Ukraine, threatening your own country because they can continue to threaten the West in general. So you need to think about it. I know it's not easy. It's also an ethical dilemma when you have to choose between two bad options. But you need to do the right thing, basically. But when all this war will finish, you need to be on the right side of the history. So rethink your position if you have a subsidiary in Russia.
Thank you so much for those words. And I think about in my book, You Can Culture, I begin my introduction with a quote from Elie Wiesel, who was a professor of Holocaust survival and Nobel laureate, who said that there may be times when we are powerless to prevent injustice, but there must never be a time when we fail to protest. And in my case, I talked about how I actually failed to protest when I was a part of a very unhealthy culture and I didn't speak up. And I just reflecting on what you say, like all of us can do something in terms of protesting. We might not be able to stop the war. We might not be able on our own stop what's going on, but there might be something we can do in terms of protest. So Gleb, thank you so much for sharing that. And just finally, what are ways that people can connect with you and follow your work?
Yeah, I can be connected through LinkedIn. It's Gleb Bakanov. And in the final, I also want to thank the Swedish people for all your help and support during this brutal, unprovoked Russian aggression. Especially, I want to thank for how you deal with and treat our refugees, our women and children, and also for your military and financial support that you are provided and are still providing to Ukraine. That helps us a lot. So my personal thanks to Sweden for all your help and support for Ukraine.
And I mean, yeah, just a reflection on that as well, that I think that most of our listeners are in the US or in other countries around the world. But as a Swede, I would just say that you are paying the real price. The price that we pay is very small in comparison. And even thinking about the refugees that you talk about, we have a community here of some friends or new friends that we meet with on a regular basis who have fled from Ukraine, women and with their children. And I'm thinking about them as heroes. I'm thinking about them as they are just as much heroes in that sense, even as the people on the front line, because they carry an incredible weight on their shoulders to care for their families, to care for the safety of their children and so on in the midst of all of this. And as you say, it is a situation with only two bad options. But I think we both and all of us hope, and in my case, pray for a change and for peace to come and justice to come, I should say, as well.
Just peace. It's our president called it. It's called just peace.
So Gleb, thank you so much for having this conversation. And from all of us, we're cheering you on and we see the incredibly important work that you're doing, and we're really hoping for a bright future for Ukraine and its people.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.